Okay, and welcome back, everyone. We're gonna get to the final part of this, and I think you've all met before, but I want to reintroduce Tracy Nicole Howeth. She is a licensed baccalaureate social worker.
Yes.
I got it right this time. I'm proud of myself. That's a mouthful. Tracy, of course, is a well-recognized leader in handling children and youth risk behavior, mental illness issues, or mental health issues, I guess would be a more appropriate term, right? And although you've done a lot, come from the University of Texas in Austin, and although retired, you're still very active in your field.
Yes.
Helping both the youth and families. You consult and support parents and schools, giving presentations, which you gave an excellent presentation the last program that we did.
Thank you very much.
On vaping in the schools. We were amazed. We were truly amazed.
Actually, Tracy stunned everyone with her data and statistics. We got a lot of comments on LinkedIn about the statistics. They could not believe it. And Tracy did an amazing job. Everybody appreciated the knowledge that you gave.
Absolutely.
Thank you 100%. Very much for that.
100% agree. In fact, I was telling you, just so you know, let me tell you what it is. Her husband, Clinton, is in the audience. Can you please mark off April 23rd? We need a talk on, it's a Thursday, on common youth behaviors with serious societal implications. So, and I'll give you this. I'll give you the title. But if it works for you, we may have to tailor it. But we really want you to come back because you really, it was a great talk that you gave.
Thank you.
With that said, going back to continuing to introduce Tracy, you are a board member and supporter of the Hands of Justice.
Yes.
Maybe you can tell us a little more about that, but you're also inspiring human trafficking awareness educator. And you work with a nonprofit agency based here in Montgomery County. So maybe you could talk a little more about Hands of Justice.
Hands of Justice, I'm extremely honored to be a part of. Rebecca Carey is their founder. And I was honored to be asked to be on her advisory board. And she and I often give presentations together. Rebecca herself is a domestic human trafficking survivor.
Really?
Yes. And she is very brave in telling her story when we give presentations. And our goal is not only to provide awareness and education to the community on how prevalent it really is in the Houston area, but also to work with rescued women and men, which unfortunately is a lot more common than you would think here in Texas. We also provide scholarships to rescued individuals. They have to apply if they are interested in going back to college. Once we help rescue them, and when I say help rescue, once the police rescue, and we help get them into homes, safety homes.
You do the transition. You do
Correct.
From rescue by law enforcement
Correct.
To then the integration back into society.
Correct. And we offer scholarships for those students that are willing to are wanting to go back to school, to college. We've had several graduate. We've given out several scholarships just in January to young men.
Wow.
So it's.
I mean, when you say this is more common than you think, how common is it really?
It's ranking up there as and I don't want to give you an exact number because it changes so frequently. And I think that can be very scary if you don't understand why it's increasing so rapidly. Part of the reason is because we are so aware. We are becoming more aware.
Yeah.
People are becoming more aware. So in our field, we don't necessarily think rising numbers are necessarily evil and bad, but it also means that people are becoming more aware.
So it's not necessarily indicative of the number of occasions this occurs is more frequent. It's that we're finding out about it, but we don't necessarily know where the top is. If you're still finding, you know, more of it, then it is occurring X percentage. Let's just assign a number to it. We don't know what that number is, however. We're here and it's still rising.
It's rising, and Rebecca has the most concrete numbers, and I should know that off the top of my head, so I apologize. I'll get back with you on that.
I kind of caught you off guard with the question.
No, that's fine. But Houston, the reason Houston is so, it's so prevalent in Houston, we have two international airports, we have a ship channel, and we have I-10 that runs from coast to coast, and it goes straight through Texas. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of ways to infiltrate trafficking into our state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting.
Kind of scary.
It is interesting. So it's safe to say, well, Dr. Samir is Catholic, for those mm-hmm. of you who don't know. And are you Catholic as well?
I'm Christian, non-denominational Christian.
Non-denominational
yes.
Christian, okay. And so, you know, I am somewhere in this spiritual realm, and this is going to be a little provocative, perhaps. It's a little more lighthearted. But I think in our industries, whether it be in the medical industry or whether it be in, no, it is the medical industry, the mental health industry. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of times when we sort of consider and think about this, like, do we have a soul? And if we do have a soul, if you believe we have a soul, where is that soul? Right. So I sort of looked at where the search for the residence of the soul, where does it actually lie? And I know you have some good thoughts on this. I'm looking forward to a provocative debate and discussion afterwards. So where's the clicker? Oh, can I borrow the clicker? Thank you, sir.
You're welcome, sir.
Okay, so going back to ancient Egyptian times, Dr. Samir is both Catholic and Egyptian. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think your grandfather was one of the pharaohs. Is that true?
Yeah, last time I checked.
Last time you checked?
Yes.
So in ancient Egyptian times, the belief was that the soul resided in the heart. In fact, upon death, if you were part of the upper echelon class, because not everybody got the same treatment, okay, you had to have money. But the only organ in the body that was preserved was the heart. The brain was sucked out, the guts were taken out, and they were put into these Capet jars and put in with the tomb of the dead in order to be used later for the afterlife. But the heart was preserved.
Okay.
And a soul was judged by the feather of truth. So when you died, you ended up going to the hall of truth, and the heart was handed over to Anubis, who was the god of the afterlife. And he placed it on a great scale, and they weighed it against the white feather of Mot, who was the goddess of harmony, justice, and truth. If the heart was lighter than the feather, you were admitted to the kingdom of heaven. However, if you perform bad deeds, anything like that, you just weren't a good person, then the heart was heavier than the feather, and it was immediately thrown to the floor and devoured by Amenti, the god who had a face of a crocodile, the front of a leopard, and the back of a rhinoceros.
I'm going to stay quiet till the end because I have a lot to say.
Can we get a side picture, side view of Dr. Samir?
Please, you know.
So. Yeah. For the Egyptians, a fate worse than death itself was non-existence. And that's what would happen. So you had to do good deeds because you had to have a light heart. But the Egyptians could buy good deeds. They could get people to do good deeds for them if they had money. There was also the Book of the Dead. Now, Egyptians are really good business people. I know you don't think they are, but they're really good business people. And the Book of the Dead had various different spells and directions in it to help you, guide you through the afterlife, because there was always these little pitfalls and different little traps that could occur. But the problem was you had to buy the book. You see, it wasn't given free. Not like you go to the hotel and you open up the drawer and there's a Gideon's Bible. See, they weren't free. The Book of the Dead cost you money. All right, so, oh, there. I forgot to change that slide. So there's a copy of the Book of the Dead. By the end of the 5th century BC, there were still questions whether the heart or the brain was in fact the seat of intelligence, and it remained unresolved in Western medicine. But by 370 BC, Hippocrates decided that, okay, the soul is in the brain, in the mind. And he has his saying there, you can read. Mm-hmm. Plato, also about the same time, the soul of man is immortal and imperishable. So clearly they're not thinking it's just in the heart, because that's still perishable. And this is so interesting that in 1485 to 1487, somewhere in that way, in that time frame, Leonardo da Vinci was the first person to pith a frog. Now, he goes on to write, this is a diagram of him doing that. When he penetrated the medulla oblongata with a needle, the frog immediately died. Prior to that, and he writes it because he did it, the frog lived without its skin, without its organs, even with the head amputated, the frog would still live. But you stick a needle into that spot, they die instantly. So he concluded from that, that that in fact is the residence of the soul. And then you have the atheists. They exist too. One of the proofs, as Mark Twain said, of the immortality of the soul is that myriads have believed it. They also believe the world was flat. Clearly we know it's not. I didn't know Mark Twain was an atheist until I read this. Did you?
I learned it in college.
You did?
Yes.
I skipped that class.
That was a good answer, Tracy. I love it. She's saying you did not learn anything in college. That's what she's saying.
Well, maybe I just paid attention in that class. That would be good.
I was either sleeping or I was daydreaming, one or the other. So I didn't know that. So in 1981, now this is where it gets really weird, okay? This is a physician. How far medicine has come in, I mean, it wasn't even 100 years. I mean, by 1940 or 50, this would have never happened. But this is a physician, Duncan McDougall. He took 6 dying patients dying of tuberculosis. And he actually published this work that he did in 1907 in the American Society for Physical Research, a really good journal at the time. But he tested 4 out of 6 patients, and I'm going to show you the actual article or the text of it. And only 4 of the 6 lost weight, but he concluded that the soul weighed 21.3 grams. Wow. So let's look at his study.
Wow.
I'm going to read it to you because it's just fun. My first subject was a man dying of tuberculosis. It seemed to me best to select a patient dying with a disease that produces great exhaustion, the death occurring with little or no muscular movement, because in such a case, the beam could be kept more perfectly balanced, at balance rather, and any loss occurring readily noted. The patient was under observation for 3 hours and 40 minutes before death, lying on a bed arranged on a light framework built upon very delicately balanced platform beam scales. The patient's comfort was looked after in every way, although he was practically moribund when placed upon the bed. He lost weight slowly at the rate of 1 ounce per hour due to evaporation of moisture in respiration and evaporation of sweat. During all 3 hours and 40 minutes, I kept the beam and slightly above balance near the upper limiting bar in order to make the test more decisive if it should come, it being death. At the end of 3 hours and 40 minutes, he expired. And suddenly, coincident with death, the beam end dropped with an audible stroke, hitting against the lower limiting bar and remaining there with no rebound. The loss was ascertained to be 3/4 of an ounce. He found the soul in 6 patients to weigh between 0.5 and 1.5 ounces.
I am ready for the
end. I'm very concerned about medicine from 1901.
Can I tell you one thing? I want to understand how. I would like to get a level of THC on that doctor.
Okay. There you go.
They didn't have edibles back then.
It does not
matter. The brownies.
Inhaling is not good sometimes, as Bill Clinton said.
That's a remarkable study that was published. That was published in a journal.
Again, the journal Medical BS, like we talked about before.
That's right. So some apocryphal stories, which are stories that probably aren't true, but they're interesting. So this heart surgeon supposedly reported to someone that when he removed the recipient's heart or the failed heart, he felt all of his life force energy being drained. But then when he would put the donor heart in, he would feel alive. He got a spark. He felt the energy of it. You know, I don't know. Have you ever heard that before?
No, but I would believe that in one thing, that you're saving a patient's life. So you're getting an energy rush from that.
But what about the other?
That's THC again.
And again, at the cost of whom? Because if the soul resides in the heart, is that person, which is really my point to the whole thing, does that person then has a transplanted soul? However, that's okay. We can talk about that later. There's also another story, apocryphal in nature, of a psychologist whose wife had a heart transplant. And he regrettably just felt like his wife was just gone, as if she lost her soul, but had another's. I don't really believe it, but it's a story. So the soul is the core of your being. Now, this is Deepak Chopra, contemporary author and alternative medicine type of guy or advocate. It is eternal. It doesn't exist in space-time. It's a field of infinite possibilities, infinite creativity. It's your internal reference point with which you should always be in touch. Now we're getting a little more philosophical. You know, it doesn't exist in space and time. It's not in your heart. It's not in your brain. But where is it? Where is it? It doesn't exist in space and time, so where is it? And I understand infinite possibilities. So this neurosurgeon, he wrote an article, which I really recommend. You can look it up with his name. Treatment of diseases by the brain by drugs or surgery necessitates an understanding of its structure and functions. Philosophical neurosurgeons soon encounter difficulties when localizing the abstract concept of a mind and soul within what is a very tangible 1,300-gram organ containing 100 billion neurons. And he's British, so that's not misspelled. That's just how they write it. Hippocrates, as I said earlier, had also focused attention on the brain as the seat of the mind. Then there's Phineas Gage. I didn't know who Phineas Gage was. Apparently, this is a case that many neurosurgeons are usually taught as they're going through their residencies and fellowships. But in 1848, he was a railway foreman. He was well recognized by everybody, liked by all, trustworthy, hardworking, dependable, the whole thing. He sustained a penetrating head injury. He lost little intellectual capacity. However, his personality changed. Far for the worse. He was prone to vulgarity. He became irresponsible, capricious, and he just became a horrible person. Still had all of the skill and capability and knowledge, intellect, but he became a horrible person. In fact, so much so, the company had to fire him. They had to let him go and get rid of his job. Now, he went on to do other things and eventually became better, more manageable with whatever happened to him. But if the mind, if the brain is the seat of the soul, and you have an injury to the brain, do you then also have an injury to your soul? And one would argue that, you know, how many times have we heard that person is soulless? They've done horrible things. They're a horrible person. They're soulless. Are they truly soulless? Are they really soulless? Is there such a thing as soulless? Can you be? It's a question that I just don't have the answer to. So despite having the most advanced imaging capabilities, two entities have remained enigmatic. Your mind and your soul, or are they one of the same? I don't believe they're one of the same. I don't believe your mind and your soul are combined. Some do, but where is it? The heart and lungs, somewhere in between? Is it two parts and some in the heart and others in the brain? Who knows? But it can't be the heart, because if you do a heart transplant, you're transplanting the heart. If the heart dies, you have to take the heart out and put an artificial mechanical circulatory support device in. You don't have a heart at all, but you're still very much alive. And many times you're still the same person. So I just don't believe that. Can it be in the brain? Well, I guess it can be, but can it? You can have an injury to your brain, but I don't think an injury to the brain is going to injure the soul. I can't believe that that changes your soul. It just changes your mind. That's why I think they're not. I don't think that they are interconnected. It can't exist in every cell, because every one of our cells is constantly being replaced. In fact, in 7 years, plus or minus, every cell in our body has been replaced. So it can't possibly just exist in every, a little piece of it in every single cell, or a little piece of our soul just disappears. We wouldn't have a soul after 7 or so years, right? So probably not that. So I want you to think about this. This is my final slide. And sort of when I sat down and looked at this and thought about it, I just thought about it this way. There's 250 billion stars just in our galaxy. There's 100 billion neurons in one person's brain. But there are roughly 37.2 trillion cells in a human body. Now, when you look at that picture, where'd it go? When you look at that picture, you see the vastness of space. But what is that? At the end of the day, that's energy. That's all we're looking at up there. My view, that's just one big energy field. So imagine when we look out at that as a full organism, it seems insurmountably large. But if you are one single cell in your body, looking out over the whole of all of those 37.2 trillion cells, that would probably seem pretty insurmountably large as well. Now, we don't know how big the universe is. Is it infinite? Is it not infinite? Nobody really knows. Even Einstein wasn't certain. But again, condense everything down to one cell, because all we are is a collection of one cell at a time. Our whole being is insurmountably large. So the real answer is, I don't know where the hell the soul is. I don't even believe in hell. However, I don't believe in hell.
Okay.
You probably do. And we can have that discussion. I don't believe in it. I believe in standby, where you may not make it to the top, but I don't believe in the pit of fire. So want to make sure I acknowledge the people that wrote the stuff that I referred to. We'll go to the camera, and Tracy, I'm turning it over to you.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, Lord. Well, you're sitting there going, looking at me.
You demanded my attention, Joe.
I demanded it.
You
yes.
You did. You demanded and commanded my attention.
Tell me what you think. Where's the soul live?
In my opinion,
Yes, and there's no right answer.
No, there is no right answer. But in my opinion, I believe that the soul resides in the brain and the heart.
I do.
And I believe that because I believe that the soul is human, and or it's what we are as a human here on earth. Mm-hmm. And in your heart and your brain, I believe that it dictates your energy, mm-hmm. your integrity, your appetites, your faith, your what makes you human. So mm-hmm. I believe that involves both heart and head. But I also strongly believe, especially after working with kids and families for so long, that external factors can play a big part in impacting a person's soul. For example, if someone has convictions, very strong convictions that they truly believe are right, mm-hmm. that don't align with your convictions and your beliefs and what goes on in your soul, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're right or wrong, or you're right or wrong. Mm-hmm. It's just what they, it's a belief mm-hmm. and a respect amongst people. But I mm-hmm. believe your soul resides in your brain and your heart and your being.
How do you reconcile the heart transplant patient? How do you reconcile, what happens?
As a matter of fact, my uncle had a full heart transplant many years ago. Mm-hmm. And I've had this conversation with my aunt. Mm-hmm. And they are very strong in their Christian faith. And they prayed about that. And they prayed that God would allow the heart that comes into his body to allow him to maintain and retain his personal soul, mm-hmm. his own personal mm-hmm. belief system and soul. Mm-hmm. So we reconciled it through our faith. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes sense.
It does. I mean, I think faith can reconcile a lot of things. It can. And I want you to get involved in this.
Oh, don't worry. I am
definitely not an atheist. Definitely not an atheist. And men and women, human beings, we don't want to, it's very hard for us to believe in non-existence, kind of like the Egyptians. A fate worse than death was to not exist anymore. Mm-hmm. And so, we are born, we start collecting these memories and having this experience of all different kinds. There's some people that have great lives, some people that have, mediocre lives, some people that have horrible lives. And some people's lives are all three of those things through various different vacillations of it during the course of their lifetime. I don't want to believe that there's nothing. I just have a hard time necessarily believing the heaven and hell part of religious teachings, Judeo-Christian beliefs. I know there's other faiths out there that have different ideas right. about what happens to you.
Right.
But I'm kind of on the fence a little bit.
Sure.
I think that you can have injury, you can have mm-hmm. medication, you can have just simply biology mm-hmm. that completely screws your brain up chemically. Mm-hmm. You can have chemical imbalances that mm-hmm. cause you to do all kinds of things, which mm-hmm. can get you pretty severely punished here on earth
right.
when you get caught with that. But it's hard for me to believe that it's not a chemical imbalance. It's Satan causing this person to do that, and they're satanic, therefore, and are doomed to the pit of fire for all eternity, when really at the end of the day, they were sick. Mm-hmm. It's hard for me to reconcile. It doesn't mean they should just linger in society. I don't believe that. Don't think I'm one of those people that, just let everybody out. There's nothing, we have to help them. No, you go killing people or doing something really bad.
Right.
You need to be put someplace. But there's something fundamentally wrong. Clearly.
I agree with that. And I my perspective, I know, is completely different than the medical perspective. Because in my job, when I have a client sitting across from me, whether it's a 6-year-old child, an 18-year-old child, or a young adult, they may not have the vocabulary or the background or the life skills to express right and wrong if they haven't been taught that. They may not have that ability to explain why they did what they did. And so it is not my job to judge them. It is my job to meet them where they are, respect their beliefs and their values, whatever they may be, and not interject my own. Even if I'm sitting there thinking, kids, you're about to go to jail, you know, because it's my job to, and my passion to look deeper. The youngest gang member that I've had in my office that told me, Miss, they told me that if I killed someone to be in their gang, that they would love me and they would be my family forever. That was the first person that ever told this kid that they loved him. How old do you think that kiddo was?
9.
9 years old. 9 years old. And he was expected to go out and kill somebody to prove his worth.
Right.
And value to this gang.
Yeah.
Does he have a soul? Sure, somewhere in there, I'm sure he does. But has he had the ability to grow it? Make any sense?
Yes, it makes perfectly good sense to me. But let me get, and I've got some thoughts about that, but I'm going to say this first. Our job is easy. We use data, imaging. We have anatomy. It's always there. It's going to be there. It was there yesterday. What you do, far more complex, because you're dealing with something that you just really can't see and measure. And it's controlled by so many things that we have no clue what is actually going on. My job's easy.
See, and I disagree with you on your job being easy, first of all, because y'all impress the hell out of me. But one of the things that you guys can do, or medical professionals or social workers or teachers, that I think it's super important. I got to give props to my daughter. She's a nursing student. I talked to her last night.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Tell her to come work here.
Devin, you want to come work here?
Devin, got to come work. Work in Houston, work in Woodlands.
Exactly. I had a great conversation with her about this last night. As a matter of fact, she's doing her clinical rotation at the VA this semester. And she said, Mom, I think it is super important as healthcare professionals or social workers or educators or first responders to remember that when we go in, we may have anatomy, we may have everything you just described. She said, but the one thing that we can't forget to offer the patient or the client is hope and compassion. And she said, because if we don't go in with some sort of a hope and a compassion, no matter how dire the circumstance, the patient is going to pick up on that. So it's harder for you guys than you think, because you have to go in and give bad news a lot.
I know heart surgeons that will refuse to operate on a patient that says, I'm not going to make it through this case. And they have refused to operate on them because of that. And I think there's a tremendous amount of influence the power of thought and suggestion can have
exactly
on the outcome of a patient.
Exactly. And recovery.
Absolutely.
As well. Right. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's okay.
Okay, I'm going to answer the last one first and then go from there. I do believe if a patient tells me I'm going to die today, I believe the patients have an insight in themselves. You cannot ignore that and dismiss it. Patients knows what their soul is feeling, good to the soul. And if the patient says that, I do agree with that, that they need, we need to stop what we're doing and really look at what the patient is saying. And I agree with the heart surgeons that don't operate. The patient says that. I think cancel and go for another day. Get spiritual care, try to figure out what's going on, which if we can. Now, let me start with clinically. Now, clinically, like you were talking about heart and the brain, unfortunately, and the neurosurgeons will tell you, neurologists, heart is much more advanced than the field of neuro, much more advanced. Heart has failed, like you said. Take the heart out, put a valve, plug it in, it's all good. Brain fails, there's no solution.
No.
And how to heal somebody has figured that out, research is ongoing. And I'll tell you, there's not really anything on the highlights right now. So poor neurologists and neurosurgeons have a hard time. They're trying to figure something which nobody has figured out yet. Now I'll tell you about the soul. I mean, I do believe in having a soul. And I believe your soul, I'm not sure what you want to say to your soul, but I believe who your soul carries over. You have to pay it forward. You have to have what people will remember after you're gone. You want to call it your soul, or that you paid it forward.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you treated your legacy.
Yes.
Okay. So yes. What is your legacy? Is your legacy going to be money and buildings? No. People remember how you treated them.
Right.
And how you affected their life. And I will say it here. I'm sorry to embarrass him. Somebody like Clinton right here. The way he treated me the first time when I met him here made me always feel that now he has a legacy in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I believe, is part of the soul situation. It's your legacy. You have to be really, I only think you have your legacy is one time.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot ruin it. It's never, you cannot fix it again. You have to take every action that you do today and every day that's affecting your legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very important to me. My credibility, my legacy is very important to me. I cannot tell you I'm a good person, I'm a bad person. I don't know. I don't know what a good and a bad person
You're a good
is.
Person.
No, it really does
but
not
I'll
matter.
Give you the, you are.
And I'll tell you,
yes. Mostly.
I'll tell you.
Most.
Thank you, sir.
There's
and I'll
times.
Tell you, I go to church, and maybe some people are going to be mad at me. I go to church, not because the priest is in church, because what's going on in church? Because when I go there, there's a group of people mm-hmm. that are always waiting for me to go that day. And they know if I'm not there, there is something wrong, and they worry about me.
Mm-hmm.
And those group of people, I feel I owe them to show up every time because they're my group. They care about me.
Mm-hmm.
They think when I'm not there, they have a seat for me because they know I have a hard time. And they're always looking out for me. The person giving me communion every time is looking out where am I sitting to give me communion. For me, that is like, that's their soul, whatever you want to call it, but I look that for every time I go. Mm-hmm. So that's my little simplified. You know, I'm a simpleton.
Simple. That's okay. Very good. But I think it's very good. I think it's meaningful. I think sometimes the deepest, most meaningful things are really quite simple.
Right.
And we overanalyze a whole lot of things, at least I know I do. So you believe it's in the heart and the brain. So you believe the mind and the soul are interconnected.
With the heart.
And all of them are connected.
Yes.
Dr. Samir, does it reside in us, around us, all of us, next to us? What do you think?
I think I'm going to have to go with the Asian teaching. It does reside in you, and you can feel it from one person to the other.
You think it resides in us,
yes.
But not necessarily heart and lungs,
no.
Heart and brain.
No.
And, yeah, answer it. Hello, you're on the air. Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're on the air.
John Ingram.
Who's this?
John Ingram.
Hey, John, how are you?
How's it going?
Doing good. What do you think?
I'm watching you live, am I not?
Yes. Yeah, we're right here, waving
okay.
at you. Hey, John.
Oh, there's a delay. There's a delay, okay. Yeah, it's John Ingram. Hey, it's John Ingram. How you guys doing?
We're doing good. We hear you.
He has to turn off.
Okay, well.
Tell him. Hey, John, you have to turn your volume down. We're getting that feedback back.
Let me try a couple of things. Is it any better now?
It's fine for us.
Okay. So I think it's my phone gets too close to the computer. I think that's what it is. So I wanted to interject, almost every religion believes that animals do not have a soul. Humans, what separates us from animals is that we as humans have a soul, right?
Yep.
So, if you've ever had a pet dog, like I'm a big dog person,
yeah.
Our little dog, he has a personality. He knows right from wrong based on what we've taught him. He has everything, but he's not human. And if he's an animal, so he doesn't search for religion. He doesn't search for, he doesn't seem to have a need for a moral compass like humans do. So, if it's in the brain, well, he has a brain. If it's in the heart, well, he has a heart. lungs, whatever, but yet doesn't have a soul, right? According to most religions. But just talking about religion for a second, it does give you a moral compass, whichever one you believe in. At least it gives you a moral compass of right and wrong. And but going back to the animal thing, I think if you want to find where the soul resides, you have to try to find what's different about a group of animals than humans. If you follow a pack of lions from one country to the next, they're all doing the same thing. They're hunting to survive, but they don't have different religions among themselves. They don't have different rules of right and wrong because they're not in search of some eternal accomplishment or some internal existence beyond this. They're just here for survival. And I once heard it said, not that I believe this, but I once heard it said that if you want to know exactly how it is once you die, it was exactly how it was before you were born.
Yeah.
Which you could argue that because maybe there was an existence before you were born, but you just can't recall it in this present state of this of the physical being that you're in. So I just wanted to give you some thoughts about that.
You know, John, I've heard that same thing, that we, you know, that there are people that believe we come from nothing,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
but then we are. And because of our perhaps larger brain, you know, we're more sentient. We think about, you know, our existence and why we question why, whereas animals don't question why. We, at least we don't think they do.
Right.
But then it's very difficult for us to imagine what is an inevitability. Every single day is an opportunity for it to be our last one. And it's, you know, there's no predictability to it. And that frightens humans. The human experience, I think, is one of the most interesting and unique ones around. But, you know, I think that, you know, that other species, you know, it's, I hear what you're saying, the domesticated dog, you know, there are certainly some, you know, more advanced ape species, monkey species, primate species is what I'm trying to say. You know, they have some pretty significant definitive personalities. Mm-hmm. And some of them, you know, they may not have religion as we know it, or do we know what they do? Do we? We don't know what they think. And I think to your point, Dr. Smear, the brain is so incredibly complex, and what is it? Dopamine and some other neuroreceptors, and
epinephrine.
That many neurons, and even more synapses than that.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about how 100 billion neurons, 100 billion. That's a very big number just in one skull. It's very. I don't think we'll ever understand it, frankly. I don't think we can. But we know that if you do like Phineas Gage and stick a pipe through the front of your head and damage your frontal lobe, you become a different person.
I'm not sure I believe that, to be honest with you. I do believe that if you have a catastrophic event that could reflect on you in different ways, I think it depends on the person themselves, not if two people are alike. If you have a catastrophic event, it will affect your outlook on life in different ways. So I think I don't believe in that, to be honest.
So you don't think the frontal lobe is the harbinger of, or not the harbinger, but the heart where your personality is harbored?
No, it is. I mean, there's talk, and I'm going to say talk because I can know it's all unconfirmed. There's the inhibition lobe. You become disinhibited when you have a frontal lobe injury. But again, they do not know. Mm-hmm. In the heart, you know that the left ventricle is the left ventricle.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Exactly. Agreed. It's pumping blood to the body. Neuro is all postulation.
Mm-hmm. All of it. I agree.
Absolutely.
Well, if you look at trauma, people that are victim, you know, that suffer with trauma, every single trauma victim, be it severe post-trauma or systematic post-trauma or situational post-trauma, every person is going to handle that differently, depending on how they process it in their brain.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we see that more and more in our veterans.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. That's why people say when they're recovering from a trauma or from a stroke, that's the way it should be. that there's nobody following a blueprint.
Right.
The blueprint is your own blueprint. Mm-hmm. So I think there's so much we don't know in this area.
Which is fascinating. Mm-hmm. You can take two people. You can take identical twins, yes. Subject them to the same event, and they will each handle it differently.
Correct.
Absolutely.
And that's just dopamine and epi. Mm-hmm. Neurotransmitters. Mm-hmm. Where they go, how it fires, what fires. I mean, we just don't know. It's just, but getting back to the soul, if we have a soul, I don't believe that it is discernible. I don't believe it lives in the heart and the brain. I think if we do have a soul, we are our soul.
And that's what I was saying earlier, is that it is you, your humanness. It's you as a human, heart, brain, all of you makes up your soul.
Yes, absolutely. But I don't necessarily believe that people that do bad things do so because they have a bad soul.
They may not have a conscience.
They may not. Well, they're sociopaths. Sociopaths don't have conscience.
And then they're,
but
right.
Why? That's the billion-dollar question. Is it because they have a bad soul, or is it because they have a yet not understood biochemical imbalance? Which is it?
So,
John?
Yeah, so let me ask you this, because you can talk about heart transplants and lung transplants and how the person feels after. What if you had a body and you were able to take a different person's brain and do a brain transplant? Now, that person that received the transplant, is that body the person, or is that new brain that came in that person? And the consciousness is going to come with it, is it not? The consciousness of that brain is going to come with it. And basically, a huge part of your soul is that we were born with a conscience, that animals generally don't have much of a conscience, right? So it seems to me, if you had the isolated organ, it seems to me it must largely be in the brain. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think so. But I, again, you know, that it's philosophical. Mm-hmm. Is, you know, is our mind, which is what's going to consist of our memories and our behaviors and all of that kind of thing, is it the same as the soul, or are they two, you know, completely different things? And so I think that's really the question. If you believe that the soul resides in the brain, then yeah, you transplant the head, that brain and soul goes with it. If you believe it's in the heart or a combination, then I guess you're gonna have, you know, two halves of the soul. I don't know what's gonna happen. So, you know, I just, I have no clue. But I do know that when you look out into space, it looks insurmountably big. But one cell in 32.7 trillion cells would probably look insurmountably big. So, you know, I think our soul is just, it exists as an energy field that has nothing to do with our physical state. Essentially what I was trying to say.
Okay.
Then how is it attached?
How is it attached to us? I mean, look at quantum physics and quantum mechanics. How is it possible that, you know, this solid desk is really porous? You know, I mean, there's things that I just don't know. And Einstein's not here anymore, so I can't ask him. Dr. Samir, let's close it out.
Again, I believe it's all polyfactorial. And the only thing that we have is our soul is there to help us determines who we are in the future. So, and it's a collection of our memories and our experiences. And I do believe, yes, if you transplant somebody's brain to somebody else, they're going to have to adopt that memory.
Yes, of course.
Of course. I mean, you have to be logical. You transplant somebody's heart. The heart's the same heart, the same RV, same LV,
yeah.
Same mitral valve.
Right.
Will behave that same way. So by logic, it has to be the same way.
Yes. Yeah. But you're not going to take a brain, you're you're transplanting, if you're transplanting, I mean, you know, I mean, they are experimenting with transplanting heads. I mean, they are actually doing these experiments. But it would be because the brain was still intact, but the physical body was dying and couldn't continue to keep the brain alive. Who we are is all up here. I mean, that's who we are. So, you know, you're not taking a bad brain and putting it into somebody or just transplanting brains for the sake of transplanting brains.
I mean, I'll tell you, I never use that word because, you know, I'm happy to transplant. There's no bad organ. We're always going to take an appropriate organ for you.
Okay, I think on that note, John, it was good talking to you. Thanks so much for calling in. Hey, Dr. Samir is taking you to Egypt, and we're sending you a Perf Web cup. Thanks very much.